Hello, I am Alberto Grignolo. I'm the deputy editor for DIA Global Forum magazine. We are at the 2015 DIA Euro meeting in Paris, and we're speaking with Dr. Michael Rosenblatt, who is executive vice president and chief medical officer at Merck. Previously, his distinguished career included dean at the Tufts University School of Medicine. He was also president of Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center and was dean of the Harvard faculty. And importantly for DIA, he is the co-chair of the DIA 2015 annual meeting that will occur in Washington June 14 through 18. Welcome, Dr. Rosenblatt. Very happy to be with you today.
Thank you, Alberto. It's a real opportunity for me.
Glad to be with you. The first question I'd like to address has to do with data transparency. And by way of backdrop for our listeners, there's high visibility now for clinical trial data transparency. The European Medicines Agency has a clinical trial data sharing policy in place, initially requiring publication only of clinical trial reports for all newly approved drugs. A second phase review of various aspects in relation to individual patient data, or IPD, will include finding the most appropriate way to make IPD available in compliance with privacy and data protection laws. In the United States, Health and Human Services has proposed new rules requiring clinical trial sponsors to report the summary results of all clinical trials, not just those for products receiving FDA approval. The Office of the Inspector General at HHS has a 2015 work plan that includes oversight of the extent to which clinical trials comply with the reporting requirements set forth by the FDA Amendments Act and the way in which FDA is ensuring that these requirements are met. Large Pharma and Project Data Sphere, the Yale University Open Data Access Project, the IOM report from last January, are opening previously closed data sets to the public for use. The Open FDA initiative allows access to a public database for analyzing drug and device adverse events, recalls, and labeling information. So it seems that 2015 will be an important year for clinical trial data transparency and sharing, with implementation activities in full swing. So with that backdrop, my question is, while most outcomes envisioned from more sharing of and transparency in clinical data are positive, do you envision any negative outcomes? What are, for example, some points to consider to balance the needs of the larger population against the privacy of an individual patient? Would appreciate your thoughts on that.
Well, thank you, Alberto. It's a very good question, and it's a very complicated area. And I think the trend is very clear that more clinical trial data will be open and more will be shared. And there is great potential benefit there, although there are not yet a lot of examples where new insights have come. My own view is that we should look at this the way we look at almost everything in medicine, which is from the lens of benefit risk. What's the potential benefit, and what's the potential risk? And so if we take a clinical trial data set down to the level of patient-level data, and then we want to ask questions of it, we should understand what are the risks in sharing data and sharing data more widely than it was originally intended. First of all, I think it's difficult to go back and look at data unless informed consent was given. And in many cases, we don't have informed consent. So I would say going forward, how can we use this data? And then when you look at the potential risks, which are important to weigh them against the potential benefits, most of the discussion comes from Europe and the United States, in which we have a belief that the data can be secured and individual patient-level data can be de-identified and anonymized, and that even if there's a breach, it's not so terrible. After all, look at what people put on Facebook. But you know, most of the phase three clinical trials done by large companies now, they are done globally. And as a chief medical officer for a company, I see some of the data as representing a potential safety risk for patients in the following way. these medical records may have information about your religious preference, your sexual preference, your ethnicity. And we all know that those can be, that information in other countries in the world, in other regions of the world, can be catastrophic, even fatal. So, in fact, we're not able to say that the data is absolutely secure once we start sharing it widely. Every day we read in the newspapers that the data sets of the Swiss banks have been broken into. And if they can be broken into, imagine that it's not so hard to break into medical records or big companies, big retail chains, and others. So I don't think we can make an assurance to patients. We should tell patients, if they're going to share their data, that there is a risk, and we should have informed consent about that. The last thing I would say on this topic is that the question of keeping the data secure and keeping it anonymous gets more and more difficult as you go along. We're at the early stages of having genetic information about patients, but there's no question that genetic information is an absolute identifier. So if you know a little bit of, if you know the genetic information and just a bit of demographics, you actually can go back and identify who the person is. And there's a very nice example of this about 2 years ago from the Whitehead Institute at MIT, where they not only were able to identify anonymous people in their gene data, medical records, but family members, because it was genetic information. So I would just conclude by saying again, there are risks. I see them as safety risks. They may or may not be worth taking. And what we have to do is be good doctors and say, is the benefit in this particular case worth the potential risk that I'm taking for these patients?
That's a wonderful perspective. There are those who say that, you know, there's no private information anymore because everything is on Facebook. There are others who say, well, I've never been on Facebook. I don't plan to be there.
Right.
So how does one reconcile the characteristics of those of the former category that say, well, there are no more secrets in the world anyway,
right,
and others who cling, yeah, to the privacy of their information at all costs and refuse to participate in social media? Should there be tailored approaches? Is there one-size-fits-all approach? How does one look at this?
Well, I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all approach. I think it's not for us to choose whether a patient's data is shared or whether a patient's data is revealed. That's not for us to choose. That's for the patient to choose. It does pose a problem, for potential problem, for enrollment in clinical trials, because some people will say, well, if a condition of being enrolled is that my data is shared, I'm not going to participate, and that could potentially distort things. As you said, I think the vast majority of people are actually willing to share their data and willing to take the risk, whether they fully understand the risk or not. And I don't have a solution to your very good question about what to do with those people who say, you know, absolutely, I don't want to share.
If a patient comes to you as his or her physician and says, well, doctor, I really don't know what to decide. What do you recommend that I do with my data? Should I make it public or available, or should I keep it private? Doctor, please tell me, doctor, I don't know. Yeah. What would you say?
Well, I would say that I would begin with, what is there in your medical record, and in the society we live with, you know, there are certain diagnoses that are stigmas, things like depression or hospitalization for psychiatric problems, certain diseases, hepatitis C, AIDS, etc. So I would begin with, you know, the patient, asking the patient, well, how would you feel? There's a very small chance that that could be revealed, but how would you feel about that? What would be the impact on you and your family, your work, et cetera? And, have that kind of discussion with a patient. And then I think you could plan on how to handle that going forward. And there may be some people where they'll say, you know, it's for me, I would have liked to contribute to the advance of medical knowledge, but it's not for me. And I also think it's important to remember that most of the advances in medicine that we will see are probably not from secondary analyses of medical data. They're from the generation of new medical data about innovation. So there'll be some compromise, but the big, big enterprise that we're involved in to invent new things to advance healthcare, that comes from a different process.
What you've described in your answer to this hypothetical patient, it sounds like informed consent, providing yes. to the patient enough information so the patient will make a decision. Yes. Does the current informed consent process have enough latitude to accommodate the new possibilities and concerns relating to data privacy, or does it need to be enhanced in some way?
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't know what everybody's different informed consent language looks like, but when we've looked at our own, it's only recently that we feel that we're building in there some specificity about the potential to share. So, you know, some people consider the granting of informed consent as a blanket kind of permission. Mm-hmm. We tend to be conservative about that and say no. Now, you know, we need to remember, I don't think that there has been a breach in patient confidentiality in data held from clinical trials by pharmaceutical companies ever, to my knowledge. I may be wrong. So this is a big step to take it and share it. Every company that I know is willing to do it. We want to do it for the right reasons, but we want to be very careful because the thing that we've safeguarded so effectively for so long, we don't want to lose that part of what we've done going forward.
Particularly perhaps at a time when patient enrollment in clinical trials, at least in countries like the United States, could be higher, shall we say, or is not as high as it could be or should be. So yes. further discouraging patients from participating in clinical trials because their private information may not stay private may be something to think about.
Exactly, so that's extremely important. And then there's the more difficult to measure whole issue of trust, and do we trust the people that if we want to enter into a clinical trial, do we have the right trust there? Have we earned the trust? So these are intangibles, but extremely important.
They are indeed. Well, thank you. Let me move to another topic. If I can ask you to put your hat as Dean of Tufts back on after a few years. Current discussion about advancing innovation in clinical research and healthcare product development has focused on the dynamics among industry, patient groups, payers, regulatory agencies. But what, if anything, can medical schools do to contribute to this advancement?
Well, there are a number of things that I think that medical schools are well positioned to do. First of all, to really succeed in bringing new innovations to healthcare, no single sector can do that alone. You really need collaboration. And medical schools are well positioned to foster the collaboration. They can convene these different groups, not only their own academic group and the industry, but regulators, funders of research. They can bring them all together to think about what are the big problems and how we tackle them. And not only can they be a convener, they can be a kind of safe harbor for discussions that are more delicate and difficult to have. And that's a safe place to have them. You're all kind of under the academic enterprise. So that's one big arena in which they can bring their own discoveries and contributions to innovation and have them interface with everyone in a productive kind of environment. The other thing is when you look ahead at what it really takes to take an innovation and move it all the way to the bedside through regulatory approval, et cetera, it's not clear to me that we have enough of a pipeline of trained people, not only the pipeline of innovation, but the pipeline of trained people who can help with that, clinical researchers, people well-versed in regulatory science, et cetera. So, of course, medical schools are a very good place to do this kind of training. And it begins with their curriculum, training medical students about the conduct of clinical trials, why clinical trials are important, the kind of oversight that regulators really bring to the process of bringing drugs forward so that things don't get into the hands of the public unless they have been really carefully scrutinized. I think the average doctor who writes a prescription really doesn't have a sense of what's behind that description, either in terms of discovery or development or regulatory oversight.
So you're calling for a degree of enhancement of the medical school curriculum for medical students and maybe interns, residents, and fellows?
I am calling for that. I guess you're right. I'm calling for that. You know, when if you think about it, for instance, in other fields, we produce computer scientists, experts in information technology. Well, we wouldn't dream of giving people degrees in those areas unless they understood how a computer worked, right? They have to know a little bit about the hardware of how a computer works. Well, we're producing doctors year after year who really have no idea of how that pill got to them to prescribe it. And I think it will benefit everyone, patients especially, and physicians, if there's some understanding of the process, and maybe they can all contribute to improving the process going forward.
Is there a role for industry to play in this, shall we say, enhancement of the medical school curriculum, or should there be a separation between industry and medical schools for lots of reasons that people have talked about over the years?
Yeah, well, I'm generally not one for the artificial separation of dialogue and exchange. I think there are aspects that need to be regulated or controlled. You certainly don't want to offer a course in drug discovery or development and then have it become promotional because you've involved industry. So products don't belong there, but I think providing the actual experience and know-how that industry has that academia doesn't have is a very good thing that students and young faculty will value. And so they can be adjunct faculty, industry-based people can be adjunct faculty and contribute to such courses. And also, you know, people in training, those going into biomedical research, many of them are interested in a research experience through an industry lab. And it could be part of PhD programs or part of postdoctoral fellowships to rotate through an industry lab and get a feeling for that. After all, about half of the careers in biomedical sciences are in the private sector and the other half in academia. So why not open these worlds, but being careful to exactly the kinds of things you mentioned at the beginning of your question.
Right. Continuing on this for just another moment, should the medical school curriculum cover things like the voice of the patient, ironically though that may sound to budding doctors, but also the voice of the payers in the healthcare policy and expenditure community? I mean, should young doctors be made familiar with those issues which impact the use of drugs and the reimbursement of drugs?
Well, I think that they should. They're going to be living in that world. We may as well equip them to live in that world. I also think, I've thought about this in my own career, that as a physician, for much of my career, I thought that I could represent the viewpoint of the patient. And I could to some extent, but not fully. If you're really honest with yourself, the best way to know a patient's view on something is to ask the patient, right? There's no substitute for that. And so having medical students understand that the doctor is not omniscient, doctor knows a lot, brings a lot of value to the health of a patient, but still, at the end of the day, it always pays to listen to the patient. And on the payer side, I think that could be extremely valuable You know, one of the things that in general I've been a little disappointed with my own community of physicians is that as payers begin to shape what doctors can do and what they can't do, what tests they can order, what medicines they can prescribe, it's almost in some ways opposite to personalized medicine or precision medicine, which is trying to get you to tailor the things that are best for the patient, but the economic pressures are, can we find one size fits all? And so I think if we train young physicians to understand the perspective of the payer and speak the payer's language, then they will be able to be better advocates for their own patients down the line.
Very interesting. Well, I could go on this track for hours, but in the interest of time, let me move to a different topic and ask you to again put on your hat as chief medical officer in a pharmaceutical company. And I know that earlier today you were in a session on the role of medical affairs going forward. So what is your view of the evolving role of medical affairs in industry as a voice of the patient and perhaps as a voice for the value of a medicine? Has this role changed significantly in recent years? How and why?
Well, the role of I think medical affairs is changing. It's a complicated role, and the reason it's complicated is that the outside world has gotten more complicated, and we're either reacting to it or, when we're smart, trying to plan in anticipation of where the field is going. The medical affairs function in the pharmaceutical industry is a very privileged place because that's the direct interface with physicians outside the company, physicians inside the company interacting with physicians outside the company. And so I think that the fabric of that interaction ought to be on the best practice of medicine, not so much on particular products. And one way that I look at this is you have the physicians inside the company in medical affairs. You've got physicians outside the company who you want to interact with. And there's a highway that's going in both directions. It's very helpful to get their perspective, for instance, on where is their field going? Where is cardiology going? What are the needs in pharmacology, in cardiology? What's acceptable in cardiology? What will be acceptable a few years from now? So that input is extremely valuable to companies strategically. At the same time, you would like to get output to these physicians on the outside, tell them the kinds of things you're working on, the issues that you're encountering, promoting some understanding. And one of the challenges here is that it's kind of a hydraulic system, so that the more time and the temptation that you spend on, I want to tell these doctors about my product, the less opportunity and credibility and trust you have to get input from them and to talk about the big issues of where the field is going. If you make the other choice and you say, this highway is mostly about getting input, listening to them, or just having a real discussion about medicine and where it's going, then you don't have so much opportunity to talk about products. My view is that more and more product information will be obtained by physicians through multiple channels, but it's the input you can only get in certain ways, and the peer-to-peer, physician-to-physician discussion and dialogue is what's so special, and that's what medical affairs can do.
So somewhat ironically, I guess, as I listen to you, the medical affairs unit of a pharmaceutical company should not be discussing that company's products with the doctors that it communicates with.
I don't know that I would say shouldn't, but maybe it needs to be kind of invited to, or the information comes in the context of the best practice of medicine, taking care of, let's say, a group of patients. Where does your agent fit in? Where does it specifically not fit in? But that's not where the conversation begins. It doesn't begin with, hello, doctor, I would like to tell you about my new diabetes drug. The conversation starts in a different way, like, how's it going taking care of the diabetes patients? You know, what are the issues you see, and how can we help?
Can the new medical affairs become a stronger voice for patients, and does it have the credibility to be the voice of patients, given that it's embedded by definition in industry?
Yes.
Is there a gap there, or maybe not?
Well, there are issues there, and I think that there's some restraint, let's say, by patients in interacting with industry. So within that context, who's better positioned to interact with patients than people on the medical side? At least there, in general, is trust for doctors. Now, your question actually hits home because I've been directly in this movie. We have reconfigured my office, the office of the chief medical officer, to take a group of physicians whose major responsibility is to interact with patient groups, patient advocates, and real patients. We have 8 of them. They represent 8 areas of strategic therapeutic importance to the company. And it's very early days. I don't know how it'll work out, but we're committed to having this group of people really work with patients to get particularly their view of benefit risk into the drug discovery, development, regulatory and reimbursement process up and down the line. So it's already, the voice of the patient is already having impact on how we are organizing ourselves.
Who is a patient? The question really has to do with who can speak for the patient on the patient side. Is it an individual patient? Is it 3 patients? Is it a patient association? Is there a range of views among patients even within a therapeutic area where one could say, well, it's hard to tell what all patients want because many of them want entirely different or even opposite things? Yeah. How hard or easy is it to get the voice of the patient properly represented and understood?
This is a really thoughtful question. So first of all, we should remember that we'll all become patients at one time or another. And we hope that our voice will be heard.
As one of the keynote speakers the other day said, health is a temporary diagnosis.
That's exactly right.
We will all be patients someday.
We will all be patients. Right. So although it's demanding of our bandwidth, I actually think all the categories that you listed are all ones that we have to pay attention to. So organized patient advocacy groups, they know the disease that they are dealing with, and they have collected views from many, many patients. But as you've noted, the way a disease plays out in an individual is different from individual to individual, and it's important to hear those voices as well. They sometimes are a little bit more difficult to get at, but always informative, and I think we don't know yet. You know, if you stand back and you look at the industry, we've spent 100 years refining our interaction with physicians, right? We know how to do that, and we're very comfortable with that. And one of the mistakes that I think we've done is to say, well, we can get all the information we need about patients by having the physician tell us that. It's not the case. And so what we need to do now is bring the same kind of care and attention that we did, that we've given to the physician relationship, now to the patient relationship, and we'll see who it is that we need to interact with at the end of that.
This seems to make great sense also in the context of what many of us have heard over the years, that physicians don't have time to talk to patients, much less listen to them, because they're allotted 3 minutes per patient per visit.
Right.
Right. So how can a physician possibly represent a patient to whom he or she has not listened, hasn't had time to? Fair enough?
Yes, I think that's fair. And I think the other thing that's fair is that in those golden olden days, the patient got virtually all of their information from the patient, from the physician. The physician was the so-called learned intermediary. They were the channel of information. We all know that's not the case anymore. Patients are getting information from all over, from the internet, from Twitter, from chat rooms, et cetera. Actually, our challenge is no longer getting information to patients. It's getting accurate information to patients.
Going back for a moment to the role of medical affairs, any role for medical affairs in relation to payers, meaning communication with payers, communication of the value of the company's medicine or medicines to payers and to the patient community? Any role for that, or is it an inappropriate role?
No, I think this varies from company to company, but I can imagine that it would be a valuable role, especially as a health technology assessment occurs, and we get, I always gravitate towards the science and the data. And so to have medical affairs just giving opinions, that's not particularly useful. But when we're dealing with payers and we can illustrate the value of what we have, either in hard data economic terms or by information we've collected from patients, then I think that the medical affairs physicians are a good means of exchanging that information with payers.
Okay. Great. Finally, let's have you put on yet another hat, and that is co-chair of the DIA annual meeting this June 2015 in Washington. May I ask you what attracted you to accept the role of co-chair, and from your professional perspective, what are you looking forward to the most in your service at the annual meeting, and even from a personal perspective?
Right. Well, first of all, I'm thrilled, I'm very honored to serve in this role as co-chair of the program, and I'm really very enthusiastic. It's a real opportunity. I think I'm going to learn a lot. There are some of the themes there are, well, let me begin more generally by saying, you know, the DIA is a place where all of these different sectors in the process of bringing innovation all the way to the bedside, they all intersect or they all converge at a place like DIA. And it's the only place I know of where all of that happens. So this is a great place where things can happen as a result of viewpoints being shared. And as I said a little bit earlier in our discussion, it's also a safe harbor for some of these discussions. Then if I go down another level, some of the themes I'm very interested in. We've been talking about patient engagement. That's one of them. Big data. I'm quite interested in how big data can be harnessed to help us understand unmet medical needs, understand how medicines work or how they fail to work in certain circumstances. Design of clinical trials is another one of the tracks that I'm seeing, and there's so many issues there. If you even just think about, for instance, Alzheimer's disease, are we doing clinical trials in the right people? We're going to people who already are having symptoms. Maybe that's too late. Well, how will we deal with it if we have to go very early and it's going to take a long time to play out? So I'm very interested in these tracks. And then I would say, you know, on the personal side, my co-chair is going to be Chris Austin from the NIH. His career path and we both have very similar training. We've both done different things and multiple things in our careers. And between our two career pathways, we cover almost all of the aspects, almost all of these sectors that I say converge.
Wow.
We've all covered it. So it's going to be a lot of fun working with him. And then just the idea of going there, being surrounded by such terrific people, such interesting conversation, and seeing friends and colleagues from many sectors, I'm really looking forward to it. The program is shaping up to be really a splendid program. So as you can see, I can't wait for June.
I can feel the passion. Indeed. On the topic of big data, you mentioned a specific personal interest in big data.
Yeah.
How close are we to be able to leverage big data in a truly useful ongoing manner?
Well, I think we're already, there are some instances where we are already beginning to use it and we are getting insights. For me, again, always going back to the science and making sure that the science is very high quality, I think it's fair to say that this field of big data is a young field and it's still evolving. This isn't like biochemistry, where we have the rules of the road and certain principles. We are still developing them. And so when I look at big data to really make it useful, and I'm confident this will happen, there are two things that have to happen. Number one is we have to set some standards. There are people who are quite eager to publish information. They get a hold of the data sets, and now it's different than doing a clinical trial where you need a whole lot of people working together to get a result. Somebody alone at a laptop, at night can crunch some data, and not only that, they don't have to publish it in peer-reviewed journals, so it can be out there and it can have a lot of impact. We've seen this in the vaccine field, right, where erroneous assertions can cause a great problem. So I would say number one is we need to get a good set of standards that the field would adhere to. And then secondly, the data itself in many cases isn't yet ready for prime time. It's either not very clean, been corrupted, it's not fit for purpose. We have large data sets. There are diagnoses that are entered for billing purposes as opposed to medical purposes, and that can lead you astray. The British Medical Journal had an article about, I think now it's about 2 years ago, and the title was, it was about the National Health Service in the UK, and it said, "Why are so many men pregnant?" It turned out that 15,000 men were carrying a diagnosis that they were going to the obstetrician, and it was because of a data miscoding of data, because there was a male diagnosis that was very close to a female one in the data. So I think standards for the data, for how you, the methodology, and then good data sets are prerequisite, and then, boy, then the sky's the limit.
Are we 5 years away or 20 years away from such useful use of big data?
I would say we're closer to 5 years away. But I think we'll have to choose our questions very carefully. We'll have to know, just like anything that we do in science, some tools can be used very effectively to answer some questions, and they don't work when you try to answer another question. And that's what we have to remember about big data.
Great. Well, with that final thought, I would like to thank you for talking with us today here in Paris, and we look forward to seeing you at the annual meeting. Thank you for your efforts on behalf of that annual meeting, and enjoy the rest of your stay here. Thank you very much, Dr. Rosenblatt. Good day.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.